Hi, everyone. And first of all, a very happy new year to all of our listeners, wherever you're listening around the world. I'm Justin Chisholm, and you're listening to the Yacht Racing Podcast with the ninth of our special episodes covering the 2021 edition of the Vendée Globe Around the World Yacht Race. I'm happy to say that in the new year, I'm once again joined by my expert co-host, Conrad Coleman. Conrad, happy new year to you, first of all.
Likewise to you. Thank you. And to all of our listeners. And just remember, during this moment of festivities, just spare a thought for the sailors that have been out there for 55 days going absolutely hammer and tongs. And are currently, even in the top 10, right on top of each other. They're close enough to throw a crumb cake at each other, but it is freezing cold out there. It is blowing a real storm. And so if anybody is hoping for a start to the new year, it will be when they finally make it around the Cape Horn.
I don't think the crumb cake would last very long in the conditions that our leading pair are experiencing. I think I'm right in saying that Yannick Bestaven is round the horn now. He's the leader of the race, and he's first around notorious Cape Horn. But he's got Charlie Darling hot on his heels, probably 10 or 11 hours behind him, which sounds like a lot, I guess, in any other sport. But in the Vendée Globe, that's really just the blink of an eye. And Conrad, the significance of this Cape Horn round in Cape Horn, the journalists and the fans, it's a major milestone in the race. Is it the same for the skippers, or is it just another turning point?
No, in this case, it truly is that the journalists and the sailors are for once on the same page with this one, because you go down to the South Pacific and you feel the exhilaration of passing through Point Nemo, of the risk of icebergs, the accompanying albatross, and it's all very special, but you get a kicking when you are down there, that's for sure. And so the opportunity to turn left and to finally scratch your way up little by little back towards the equator and some warmth and a little bit of salvation mean that this Cape Horn should really be called the Cape of Deliverance. It's an opportunity to save yourself and make it back into the Atlantic, which is the sort of home territory of so many of these sailors. You know, I was just reading the daily updates sent in from the boats, and there are a number of them that have said, I want to make it back into the Atlantic. Get me out of the Pacific. I know what to do in the Atlantic. They're really sort of counting not only the miles, but the moments. Every single gust of wind is bringing them closer to the door, and I think they're all excited for it.
And isn't it strange how perceptions can change? Because in the first few weeks of the race, when the fleet were heading south down the Atlantic, we were talking about, oh, we're getting into the beginning of the deep south, the scary South Atlantic is here, and the boats are experiencing these kind of heinous conditions for the first time. And now here we are talking about getting out into more or less the same stretch of water for some respite from the true south.
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know, to put it in perspective, the Cape of Good Hope, or the Agulhas Cape in the bottom of Africa, is at 35 degrees south. And, I've been there. Cape Town is a lovely place. There are lots of people sitting around on their patios drinking Chardonnay and soaking up the warmth of the summer. But here, Charlie Darling was just down at 58 degrees south. The Cape itself is at 55 and change, almost 56 degrees south. And I can tell you, there's nobody sitting on a patio drinking Chardonnay down in the Tierra del Fuego. It is totally brutal, and you really do feel like it is the end of the earth. And you're right, it is a matter of perspective that the sailors felt like they were getting frosty when they went around the first cape, and now you're right, they would change that in a heartbeat for the conditions that they have right now.
Let me take you back to your Cape Horn rounding last time. Tell us about that. Was it daytime? Was it nighttime? Were you close or far away?
Well, I've had the fortune to pass this great cape three times during my three circumnavigations. Once in 2012 during the Global Ocean Race, when I was leading the race, so double-handed on a Class 40. So I certainly do feel like there's a challenging place to be on a little plastic boat. And then in 2015, in the Barcelona World Race, we passed relatively close at night. And then again in the Vendée Globe, I passed at night relatively close with conditions that were relatively clement. But the memory that I have from that moment was coming out of a bank of cloud and seeing just in front of me the big red trimaran of Idec Sport that was in the process of beating the record for the Trophée Jules Verne. And so I had a bunch of people that I knew, they were friends of mine, they were on this big red trimaran just a couple of miles ahead of me. But sadly, my VHF radio was broken, or the antenna was broken, and I couldn't call them, I couldn't hail them. And so I knew that at the ends of the earth, I had buddies that were just a stone's throw away, but I couldn't talk to them. It made for a pretty exciting, memorable moment, but also just so frustrating.
I guess you knew they were down there, but you didn't know how close they were.
Yeah, that's right. It was pretty cool.
That's amazing. Now, listen, the top two boats have been chasing, or rather been chased by, or tried to hang on to, what's the best way of describing it, a pretty intense storm front that's been running with them all the way to Cape Horn. It's been really key for them to stay ahead of that, hasn't it, Conrad, on the way there? But that's meant some pretty difficult sailing.
Yeah, it's been crucial to make the selection between the top two and the rest of the fleet. Just a couple of days ago, Thomas Rouillon was still considered as part of that leading trio, and he is now 460 miles behind Yannick. So there really has been this big selection brought by this one storm. And in his daily reports, Charlie on Apivia has really made reference to the fact that he's worked incredibly hard to stay with this, knowing that this was going to be a critical juncture in the race. But I certainly feel like they have been, these were not easy miles by any stretch of the imagination. You know, having winds gusting, sustained at 40, 45, probably gusting 50, 55, when you've got a following seas into Cape Horn, this is really tough. And particularly we can see just how tough the circumstances are, the conditions are, by how far south Yannick Bestaven has chosen to round the Cape. Because the continental shelf is incredibly shallow, and you go from 3,000 meters or more of depth, and then it shelves incredibly rapidly up to a continental shelf, which then shelves again as you approach the solid land. And so he has chosen to pass the longitude of Cape Horn at 85 miles south, which is exactly what I did in 2012 during my first crossing. I also had 55 knots with me at the time, and there was no way on earth you could pay me enough money to get closer to land than that. You have to stay in deep water. It allows the sea state to be more manageable because you don't get that concentrating effect of all of the Pacific Ocean charging essentially onto a beach. You know, everybody knows what it looks like at a beach where you've got waves that are not breaking out at sea if you've got less than 10 knots of wind, but then you've always got waves breaking on the beach. It's exactly the same principle once you get to the shallow water of the continental shelf. And so you can see that the conditions are brutal and that he's being conservative by staying so far south.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about the word conservative in these situations, but I guess you're right. He described it as he described exactly that scenario in his interview this morning with the race control, and he speculated that it would be a cauldron further north. He said he couldn't even imagine what the conditions must be like given the wind, the currents, and the waves and the breaking waves that you've just described. But I thought a cauldron was a pretty good thing to avoid at this stage.
Yeah, it's pretty accurate. And it's quite incredible just when you look at the geometry of the Southern Ocean, that, of course, you've got this incredible peninsula of the bottom of South America, of course, with its humpback chain of mountains from the Andes running down. And then with the, almost like stalactites and stalagmites coming together, you've got the peninsula of Antarctica sort of reaching up on the other side as well. So you need to channel all of this energy that's been sort of pushed into the systems, into the ocean, and then you're literally putting it through the nozzle of a fire hose. So it's I know it's been said 1,000 times, but it's a really challenging, brutal place to go sailing, that's for sure.
He described today that he'd reduced sail because he wanted to slow down. He'd had a few spin outs, a few broaches where the autopilot just hadn't been able to cope with the conditions. But interestingly, he said that he had both his foils all the way out. Now we know he has smaller foils on that boat than on perhaps on a Pivier and Thomas Rion's linked out. It's interesting, isn't it, that he's still managing to sail with his foils out at that stage. Would you imagine that Charlie is using foils or would be trying to depower the boat?
Yeah, he himself has said in previous comments that he's got his foils at sort of 50% and or indeed less sometimes. And I think that there's a fundamental difference in these two boats. And what's fascinating is that we've got the older, on theory, slower boat in the lead and going faster at the moment. It goes back to something that we've talked about before at the start of this race, about having to be able to better exploit the theoretical potential of your boat. And so Yannick has got a slower boat that is certainly in contrast to Charlie's, more conservative. He doesn't have he's got very small foils, actually, even for the generation of 2016. And they can actually help calm the boat down because you've got a horizontal shaft in the water that can help stabilize the boat as well. And so, yes, it allows the boat to go faster, but what he can do is have smaller sails than he would normally, which I think he's referenced, and then keep the foils out, and that together allows him to stabilize the boat.
Sounds a little bit like training wheels, Conrad.
If I see Yannick, I'll tell him you said that, and we'll see what he says.
please don't.
So very different philosophy, and I think that the crucial thing is that Charlie is just trying to keep his boat in one piece. You know, he's got a very highly optimized boat that with very spindly, very high aspect ratio foils that are incredibly powerful, and indeed some of the people here in Lorient refer to his boat as a mobilette or a little scooter. Whereas in contrast, the older Metrocoque is more of a truck, and so he clearly has more confidence in his boat and is able to push it harder.
Interesting. When I spoke to Charlie Dallin in Paris at the press conference a few months before the start of the Vendée Globe, we talked about the conditions he was expecting on board. This is his first Vendée Globe, so he was imagining what life might be like on board. And he's a naval architect, and he said he designed the boat around himself. But the interesting comment was that he said, the moment I saw the size of the foils in real life, I knew I was going to have to make this boat safe around me to live in. I wonder now whether he's slightly regretting the size of those foils, because he's had a pretty punishing time, hasn't he?
Yeah, I think so. I think everybody ages at an accelerated rate during the Vendée Globe. I certainly started sprouting grey hairs during that race and in the lead up to it. Just managing the constant stress, as we said, for 55 days until here, is really tough. You know, Jeremy Bayou himself, somebody who is no stranger to the Vendée Globe, has said that he is completely wrung out and run out of energy as well. So I think that, we're seeing the boats, it's almost unfair because two-thirds into the race, you've got sailors that are running out of energy, boats. According to Louis Burton, he says that his boat feels like it's on its last legs. And then you get to the Cape Horn. You know, it's not like you're fresh and ready and optimized to attack this this brutal place in the race, you know, that you're here when you're tired, and that's when you need to perform your best.
I'm sure they're all tired, every single one of them, but I have to say, when I look at the videos and the interviews that Yannick Bestaven sends back from the boat, he looks pretty fresh-faced to me. Is it just me, or do you see that as well? I mean, comparing the two of them, Yannick is older than Charlie, and Charlie, I don't wish to be rude, Charlie, but Charlie's looking pretty haggard right now.
Well, who knows, you know? Time works in mysterious ways during the course of the Vendée Globe. Maybe Charlie will be older than Yannick at the end of the race.
Like the spacemen when they go into space.
Exactly. Well, I think that's what it comes down to, is that you've got these two different boats. One that's pretty strong and that looks after itself to a great degree. The other, which is more fragile. Remember, Charlie went into this expecting to win the race. You know, he'd won the warm-up race, the Trans-Jacques-Vabre, beforehand. And so he's got a highly optimized boat, a bigger budget, a more challenging boat to sail. And I think I certainly feel like the stress is definitely weighing on him. He himself says so. So yeah, it's going to be interesting. I think there's lots of head scratching that's going to be going on both in the sailors' living rooms and that of the naval architect as to, you know, what is fast in the Gulf de Morbihan and what is fast in the Southern Ocean. I think that we may have, you know, just spitballing here, may have overreached the potential in this generation of boat as to what is actually applicable in reality in the Southern Ocean. So it'll be interesting to see what people come up with in 2024.
Now, you've kind of teed me up for a question which I've been hesitant to ask for a little while, because it may, I know there are no stupid questions, Conrad, but this may be the exception to the rule. But it struck me that exactly what you said, these boats are designed and they're tested in the Mediterranean and the North Atlantic, and everything's great. We've got a fast boat and we might even do a transatlantic race or two and everything seems fine. And yet when we get down into the Southern Ocean, this is when the boats get truly tested and we find out whether they are good boats or not so good. My question is, would it ever be viable for people to test their boats in the Southern Ocean by doing that passage between Cape of Good Hope and Cape Horn as a training run, whether in one hit or in several stages?
Yeah, well, I think that's a pretty interesting idea. And, you know, it comes down to finding space within the calendar to ship or sail down to the Atlantic before you get to the Southern Ocean, to have that then as your training camp. Or alternatively, what you could do is do what Ellen MacArthur, who obviously did very well in her 2000 edition of the Vendée Globe, did, and that was build the boat in New Zealand and then do your shakedown run through the Pacific and then around the Horn and up the Atlantic before you even make it into Europe and start facing off against the other boats. So yeah, I think there's certainly a lot to be said for the fact that time on the water and relevant time on the water and the conditions that you're actually going to be racing in is crucial. And I think that that will certainly drive the naval architecture choices and pros and cons that you end up making and presenting on the start line. So I'm certainly not, you're not the first person to think this, and I'm certainly not among the only ones, even here in Lorient, who are suggesting that maybe this incredible 2020, you know, class of 2020 that we all got excited about when they were started flying around the bay are just not the best adapted for the true conditions of the race. You know, just to look back at the current battle for third place, we've got a brand new 2020 generation boat which is sitting right next to a 2008 Fino boat with straight dagger boards that is known for being overbuilt. And I think that we just haven't been, you know, in the stronger conditions, it was always said that the new boats were going to have to pull in their foils and, as the French say, do the dorande, you know, hide within your collar and sort of bend over and have a round back against the beating of the of the wind and the waves. But just having two different boats from such different generations currently battling for third place is in some ways insane, in some ways disappointing. And you know, let me just give a shout out here to Alex Thompson, because he had a very different design and philosophy of his boat. Yes, he had a new 2020 boat, but it was very different from the Verdier ones. It was optimized for VMG running with his curved foils. And I think that had he stayed in the race, or had he been able to stay in the race, then it may have been a very different race, because I think that he would have had the experience to look after the boat during the strong conditions and then push hard during the transition. The thing that has surprised me the most watching the tracker is that we haven't seen Charlie light it up during the medium to light transition periods that we've seen during the course of this race. You know, everybody knew that they were going to take it easy in the heavy stuff, but to not see him then correspondingly light it up in conditions that should suit him better, it's been really surprising. And I'm really sad that we haven't had Alex there as somebody to animate the race in a different way.
Do you think that's – have you seen that before and after his damage to his foil?
In what sense? That the tempo of the race changed?
I'm wondering, was he holding back before that damage, or is that something that he's been doing since he incurred that damage? I'm talking about Charlie now.
It's tough to know. I think the reality will come out in the debrief. But for sure, Tom Aurillon and Charlie, with their two faster boats, have underperformed in the transition periods. And as to why, well, that's only for them to know and us to find out in the press conference at the end of the race.
But as you say, it is still a very close race, and it's as big as this Cape Horn rounding is, and the significance is huge for the sailors. We've still got 7,000 odd miles of racing to go. I mean, that's longer than
two transits,
open ocean races, you know, put together. So I heard today that generally the boat that goes round Cape Horn in the lead, I think 7 out of the last 8 has gone on to win the race. We can't be that certain about this time, can we?
No, certainly not. You know, what we said last time was, you know, remember 4 years ago I was in the top 10, and when Armel finished, I was still off the coast of Brazil, stuck in a windless hole and essentially crying out the frustration into my hands, because the fleet was so spread out. To have Armel finish when I was still so far away just made the whole race feel interminable. In this case, we've got still the top 10 within 700 miles, and the top 15, well, okay, let's not go that far. We've got the top 12 in 1,000 miles when we go back to Clarice. And that is just incredible. It's a fifth of what we had last time. So I think that this is going to be a pretty close battle. It's going to be interesting to see that when we're in more moderate conditions, looking forward into the South Atlantic and then the North Atlantic, as to whether Charlie is able to uncork the potential of his boat finally, and whether he's just been sort of not quite sandbagging, but taking it easy through the South so that he could light it up later in the Atlantic. And then what's really interesting for me is going to be the battle between 4th and 10th. That you've got this peloton of boats that are all sitting on top of each other. They're all very different. They've all got different potentials of boat speed. And then again, as I said, you've got some pretty interesting reaching conditions in the Atlantic that will allow the different boat designs to come to the fore. But no, this race is far, far from over. You know, the Cape Horn is held up as this sort of magical moment, and indeed it is during the course of the race. But once you go around it, you feel as if, you know, given all the hoopla and the hype, that you should be on the home straight. But in reality, you've still got 7,000 miles to sail, the equivalent of two transatlantics in the north. And you can only really feel like you're in the home straight at another cape, Cape Finisterre, at the northwest point of Spain with, you know, 300 miles to go. That's when you can feel like you've made it.
Yeah, and as you well know, that you get that far and things are still not over, because that's when you incurred your problem, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It was with about 1,000 miles to go, just after passing through the Azores archipelago. That's when I was hit by a pretty nasty secondary low, and my boat was very tired, and I had a piece of the rigging fail, and I dismasted at the last moment. So for sure, that's what you need to keep in mind as well, because I just suggested that these sailors are going to uncork the potential of their boats once they get into the Atlantic. But let's not forget, they will have done 20, 30,000 miles of sailing. The sailors are tired, but the boats are tired as well. And so you need to really manage the state of the fact that you've got all of these boats around you, and you need to push to get the advantage. But then equally, you never quite know what gremlins are lurking in the boat from this accumulated fatigue.
So I have one more question about the Southern Ocean to ask you, because we still have the bulk of the fleet down there. When these first two boats pass that point at Cape Horn and turn left, turn their bows to the north and kind of disappear around the corner, is it a deep psychological blow to the boats that are still left behind down there? I mean, you must be happy that somebody's reached it, because it means you're getting closer too, but it must also be like, oh, I've still got all these miles to go.
No, I don't think so. I think once you get within 1,000 miles to your waypoint to Cape Horn, you know, you don't care at that point. It's just watching that number tick down with glee. And obviously, given the conditions and given the impending moment of passing that famous rock, the island of Ornos, the fact that somebody else has gone past it is of no bother at that point. You know, as I said, in my personal experience, what crushed my soul was when somebody finished and I still had so far to go. That's when it's more definitive.
Yeah, understood. The leaders are now around the Horn. They turn left, they head north. And now they're kind of, talk us through a little bit here, because now they're into some very different sailing, aren't they? Because the landmass of South America has quite a big effect on them for a while now as they head up towards the Falkland Islands. You can get some pretty, I'm remembering back to the Volvo Ocean races that I've been involved in from a comms side, and you can get some pretty interesting conditions coming off the with wind spinning off the land there.
Yeah, that's certainly true. You know, once you finally get out of the lee of the tip of the peninsula, and you make your way sort of past the island of Los Estados, that's when you're sort of finally clear. But certainly between Cape Horn and that point is when you're sailing in the lee, you've got sort of relatively sheltered conditions, but it's 140 miles of sailing in the lee with very strong tidal currents going through the Lemaire Strait. Whether you take the strait or not, or whether you go all the way around the outside, you've still got very turbulent water and very strong gusts, because you know this area of the world is known for very strong katabatic winds, of winds coming down through geographical features and in sudden accelerations. So there are certainly, you know, big gusts to be had. But when you're finally out into the strait between there and the Falklands, then it's relatively plain sailing, except for the fact that on almost every routing that you're going to run, no matter what the year or the circumstance, the Falkland Islands are straight there in the middle, which is always funny, because it's made up of two sort of island chains with a big strait running down the middle of it. And I've always had it running through the back of my mind that it would be fun to sail down that strait in between the two islands. but currently the routing looks like, at least the front boats will be heading sort of further offshore and leaving the Falklands and Port Stanley to port. And that's primarily driven by the fact that as we look into next week, when we make it to Monday, is that there is a bubble of an anticyclone, high pressure, there will be billion on top of the leaders. And then as they go into Tuesday, Wednesday, then they've got a bubble of high pressure to negotiate around the right-hand side, where they're going to be doing downwind VMG running. And so again, in the span of 48 hours, you go from ripping around Cape Horn and sort of hoping that everything's going to be okay, hang on to your hats kind of style sailing, to, nice sunny day, relatively warm, putting the big spinnaker up and trying to make the best miles northwards. And then, of course, during that time, then we've got our group in the top 10 that will, for themselves, and be rounding Cape Horn in about 30 knots from the northwest. So, enough for it to be fresh, not particularly frightening. So I hope that they get in there and get some good photos at the island. And, just think in this pack of top 10, there are a bunch of rookies out there that we've got pretty experienced guys like, Jean Le Cam. I can't count that high as to how many times he's gone around the horn. Boris has done 4. Louis Burton's done 3. But then you've got Damien, Maxime, Jean Gallo, and Benjamin Dutroux, who are all there for the first time. So, be sure to be watching for the photos of this sort of jubilant rookies finally making it to their Everest. So, it's going to be exciting to these next few days as the fleet starts to make their way through.
And the potential for a bit of compression, I guess, as the boats all round the horn, the chasing pack could close up a little and make this even more exciting.
You're rubbing your hands with glee, Justin.
a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, remember the last time that we were here in these waters, we sort of went at great lengths to try and figure out what was happening with the St. Helena High and the sort of typical South Atlantic high pressure zone. This time round, it looks like an absolute minefield. That you've got that initial bubble of high pressure earlier on in the week. That'll slow down the leaders. The other bunch in the top 10 still have pressure, so that will bring them up even closer. That's certainly true. But then as we roll into later in the week, there's a very tortured period of light winds sort of the latitude of Uruguay, that almost looks like a doldrums type scenario. That means yes, further compression, but certainly really tough to find a way further forward. We'll probably see the boats head a long way offshore in order to try and find a way through.
It's going to be fascinating stuff. Another fascinating week of watching for us. Before we speak again, let's make it next Friday. Now we've got Christmas and the New Year celebrations out of the way. But for now, Conrad, thanks for your expert insight. It's been great as usual, and I will speak to you next week.
Sounds great.